Welcome back to the American Cattleman Podcast. It's great to have you riding with us again. And coming up, we've got some cattle news for you, and then you're going to meet Dr. Bill Julian, who's the founder of Inova Bioscience and something called Promogen. This is something revolutionary that will impact your cattle business right down to those mama cows, and it's important stuff for producers as well as consumers. A bit later on, we're going to talk with first-time author Eric Grant and his book about Western artist Hollis Randall Wilford. It's a book he started writing years ago, and it is a beautiful piece of work. Thanks for being here. Let's ride.
The American Cattleman Podcast is made possible through the support of Rawhide Portable Corrals, the number one portable corral on wheels. Often imitated, never duplicated. Learn more at rawhideportablecorral.com. And by Shorty's Cowboy Hattery, where for over 30 years, a Shorty's hat means you're serious about how you look. You can trust that your hat will be handcrafted by folks that truly understand the heritage of the Western cowboy. Learn more at shortieshattery.com. Now, here's the host of the American Cattleman Podcast, Chap Ramsey.
Thank you, Hunter, and welcome to the American Cattleman Podcast. Great to have you riding with us again today. Let's start out talking about beef prices. Beef Central is reporting that it's taken at least 6 months longer than what many had expected, but demand for Australian lean beef trimmings in the U.S. is now really starting to take off as U.S. domestic rates of slaughter continue to wilt. The imported trimmings market, that's the basis of the ever-popular American hamburger, has surged. Apart from a brief time of panic buying in the U.S. and or in China in early 2022 and again in 2019, when COVID-related issues disrupted supply chains, the latest imported lean cow trimmings price is among the highest in history when measured in Aussie dollar terms. In U.S. dollar terms, the current price rise is not quite as dramatic due to the currency factor, but it is growing rapidly. Something to watch out for is declining beef kills in the U.S. due to the national herd shrinking to a 40-year low, mostly due to drought. And that's starting to have a significant impact as the sheer cost of domestically produced U.S. meat rises. When that happens, we worry that consumers will turn away from beef to less expensive proteins like pork or chicken. Stay tuned. You know, we just mentioned drought conditions, and beef is out with this story about the USDA. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced USDA is making $1.5 billion available to support conservation and climate-friendly initiatives. He said this latest effort will also bring farmers and ranchers cost savings, new revenue streams, and increased productivity. The new funding will support project grants through the USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Services Regional Conservation Partnership Program. That program prioritizes climate-smart agriculture, urban agriculture, conservationism, and environmental justice. All new grants are supported with funds from the Farm Bill and the Inflation Reduction Act. Project grants amount from range, $25,000 to $250,000. Vilsack says unprecedented demand for the Regional Conservation Partnership Program last year illustrates the strong interest in conservation among farmers and ranchers. According to USDA data, the Inflation Reduction Act has provided $19.5 billion to USDA's conservation program over 5 years. Input costs have been a major focus over the past couple of years. Everything from fertilizer to equipment to seed have gone up. And all that impacts the price of beef as farmers and ranchers deal with those costs. As written in Beef, everybody knows that the demand for feeder cattle comes from the demand for fed cattle. So anything that impacts the profitability of finished cattle is going to impact the value of feeders. And for this reason, feeder cattle values are heavily impacted by the cost of those feeder cattle going to finish. And feed prices is the most significant cost of doing all that. But there is some hope on the horizon, as corn prices do tend to moderate. Alrighty, this year, farmers and ranchers in the Texas Panhandle have had some serious problems. Back in March, the Smokehouse Creek fire burned more than 1 million acres and killed thousands of cattle, primarily in the Panhandle and in Oklahoma. Drovers reports that Cal-Maine Foods, that's the largest producer and distributor of fresh shell eggs in the U.S., announced that chickens at its facility in the southwest part of the Texas Panhandle tested positive for highly pathogenic avian influenza, HPAI. And as a result, Cal-Maine had to cull nearly 2 million chickens. Dairy producers in the Texas Panhandle have also grappled with outbreaks of HPAI in their cow herds in recent weeks. To date, the USDA has confirmed the H5N1 strain of HPAI in dairy cattle on 7 Texas farms. In addition, one dairy worker has contracted an HPAI infection and displayed mild symptoms, mostly like pink eye. But it's not all bad news. Texas Commissioner of Agriculture Sid Miller told broadcaster Chip Flory that things are getting better and getting under control. All right, stay with us, because coming up next, we're going to visit with Dr. Bill Julian about Inova Biosciences and Promogen as the American Cattleman Podcast continues.
We understand cattle. That's why the world's first hydraulic corral just keeps getting better. Our system is simple, flexible, and durable, built to keep your cattle operations easy and trouble-free. All the best features of a portable system with unmatched customer service is why Rawhide is often imitated, never duplicated. The Rawhide Portable Corral.
Hey, welcome back to American Cattleman Podcast. Great to have you with us. This is a beautiful day to be talking about sustainability and profitability with your mother cows. And with me on the hotline is Dr. William Julian, PhD, DVM. He owns a company called Inova Bioscience, and we're going to be talking about something called Promogen. Bill, welcome to the American Cattleman Podcast. Great to have you with us, sir.
Well, thank you, Chap. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, you know, this is, when we had a phone conversation just the other day, and you were talking about how you can extend the lifespan, the breeding span of cattle well into the future with your discovery called Promogen. And I'm just really excited to be able to talk to you, because every cow-calf producer in the country is looking for ways to create more profitability in their herd. And if you can actually extend the lifespan, this is big news. So let's roll on with this. Tell us first about Inova Bioscience. What is that?
Well, basically, Inova Biosciences is focused on the applications of this technology in veterinary and commercial species agriculture, which basically translates down to cattle operations. We know that these proteins have value across the board in all species. So, and the focus of Inova is to be able to represent that technology and to market technology to producers and veterinarians alike.
Without getting too far in the weeds, one of the things I think that you've discovered is that animals in the wild have a natural ability to produce longer. Would that be somewhat accurate?
What we found is that in wild, the species that we've tested, which is buffalo, white-tailed deer, gaur, which is a Indian ox, that these proteins are found at very high levels, and they are linked to survival.
Hmm. Hmm. So what have we done with the domestic cow-calf herd? What's gone wrong that you hope to fix with Promogen?
Well, once upon a time, cattlemen recognized the value of cow families. And that has changed in the last 20 years or so. And it really came about as a result of an increased use of AI as a tool. They changed focus from cultivating these cow families to looking at fixing any kind of a problem on the paternal side. And as a consequence, because these proteins are maternally inherited, they come from your mother. They've kind of been bred out of these animals. You know, my grandpa always told me, I don't care, you know, what we bred, dogs, horses, it didn't make any difference. That female always was the one that painted the picture, and it was all the male did was put a frame on it. Hmm. We kind of forgot that.
Huh. That's an excellent way to put it, isn't it? I mean, yeah, all those genetics come from the mother, and the daddy puts a frame on it. Our guest is Dr. Bill Julian, ladies and gentlemen. We call him Bill around here. He is the founder of Anova Bioscience, and we're talking about Promagen. This is a new treatment that he's hoping to take to the cow-calf world. Talk to us about the development of Promagen. How long have you been working on this, Bill?
Well, this is about a 10-year project. And it really started with work that we were doing in human medical research. And what we, with the product was developed as an aid in researching diseases like multiple sclerosis, some types of diabetes. And what we did, because what we do, what we're comfortable, our church and our pew is veterinary medicine and commercial animal agriculture. We took what we learned in this ongoing, actually, human medical program and applied it into the animal agriculture.
So am I catching that this technology could also be used for humans?
Absolutely. It was developed for use in humans. They said these diseases that I just mentioned, and for example, we've got some projects right now where the technology itself is used to assess pre-surgical risk and post-surgical recovery. That continues to be a part of the research that we're involved in.
This is amazing. You know, we follow a lot of news stories, and I got to tell you, I've not heard of any of this until you and I hooked up a week and a half ago or so. This is an amazing piece of news. Now, when we transfer this from the human to the cattle industry, how does Promagen work?
Basically, we're able to test for these proteins that are Promagen has been developed to identify, and we're able to find the individuals that are able to that are produce these proteins at very high levels. Hmm. In our studies, and it didn't make any difference what species it is, in people or in cows, we found that about a third of the population does not produce these things in physiologically effective levels. But we found another subset within those populations that are able to produce these proteins at 5 to 7 times normal. Those individuals, using my parlay, my descriptive, are super people, or if they're super cows. At the other end of the spectrum, the ones that do not produce these proteins in physiologically effective levels, to me, they're baloney cows, or baloney people, for that matter.
Huh. And then, so tell us about, is this an injectable?
No. I mean, no, it's not a therapeutic in itself.
Ah.
What we're doing is we're able to, we can test this in semen, saliva, in colostrum, in uterine fluid and respiratory fluids. And basically we're by analyzing any of those materials, we're able to identify the concentration of these proteins in that fluid. And it's directly correlated. The higher the level, the more biologically successful that individual is.
This is amazing conversation, Bill. So tell us, you would go to a cow-calf herd and then test those mama cows out there to be able to find which animals have high levels of this. Would that be accurate?
That's accurate.
And then you tell the rancher which cows are good and which cows could be not so good, baloney cows.
Yes, sir. That's it.
So your testing science
can enable these ranchers out here to be able to keep the good cows, dispose of the other ones, and then build some natural immunity or some length of time as being productive with that herd. Accurate?
Yes, sir. The way I would clarify that just a little, what we're able to do is we identify the super cows. These are the cows that that should be the nucleus of any kind of breeding program going forward. And the reason why is that, as you said, Chap, that these super cows are more disease resistant. But the other, I think, an even greater economic benefit is that they're also more feed efficient. Hmm. Everybody talks about this RFI. Nobody really understands it. But as a result of using this technology, we can identify animals that have a greater ability to basically express this relative feed intake response, where they eat less but gain more. And in a brood cow situation, basically that means that they're, first of all, it gets tied back to energy utilization. It positively affects reproductive efficiency. So these cows breed faster, they'll stick after being bred. And the thing that you've alluded to in terms of longevity, these cows will do this year after year. Hmm. They will have a calf year after year, be able to wean a heavyweight calf on less feed, so they're more eco-friendly, for lack of a better term. And they'll do it until they just run out of gas at 11 or 12.
11 or 12?
Yes, sir.
And that is substantially longer than brood cows are productive, yes?
Modern brood cows.
Yeah.
You know, once upon a time, as I said, you go back to I would say 30 years ago, maybe even a bit longer than that. And this was the norm. But again, we lost that as a result of making decisions in our breeding programs based upon current, economic demand really what people were looking for, have been looking for, is rapid growth.
Right.
And frame size. And that, as a consequence, and again, going back that we were looking at the paternal side of inheritance, that fixes all these things together. You know, this is like have kind of messed up the soup.
Wow. This is an amazing conversation. Bill Julian, ladies and gentlemen, is with us. He's with Inova. He's the founder of Inova Bioscience, and we're talking about Promogen, a new testing method that will enable ranchers out there to be able to find super cows that may already exist in their herd. Final question for you. I think this is groundbreaking, and I can't wait to let our listeners know about all this. And we have many folks, Bill, that listen to American Cattlemen Podcast that may be city folks, and they don't know anything about what we're talking about. So let's two final questions for you. First of all, can you explain the lifespan of brood cows for folks that might be living in the city? What's average?
Well, basically, if you're lucky, if they live to be five, and that's just a general statement. And there's a number of reasons they break down. It has to do with, a negative interaction with the environment. Okay. I guess because this is not a simple explanation, but basically, you know, they just, we're asking them to do a job and they do the best they can, but they just burn out.
Wow.
And the burning out is, you know, they don't go down in flames. They simply don't reproduce, which is the big deal, or they develop some type of opportunistic infection that impacts their ability to feed their calves or to reproduce again, for that matter.
This should also work in the milk herd?
Absolutely. The original work was done with dairy cows because it's so easy to measure response.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say we in our early research, you know, again, we identified the super cows, average cows, and baloney cows. The super cows outproduced the average cows by 5,000 pounds more milk, which is a lot. Mm. And they also basically had a lower disease incidence. And what we found is when you looked at the records of these super cows, they also, they were older. They stayed in the herd longer.
Wow. Final question for you, Bill. As you move ahead with all of this exciting opportunities for not only ranchers, but also in the milk industry, how are you marketing this? How are you letting folks know other than coming on the American Cattlemen podcast talking about it?
Well, right now we're in the process of putting together some strategic relationships to be able to get this technology out in the field. We're working with companies like Transova. We are in discussions with Neogen to for them to be able to be part of the testing organogram, if you would. And we're working with several organizations that are focused on the development of profitable, sustainable product, branded products that are sold as being eco-friendly.
And this does transfer, doesn't it, to the consumer?
Absolutely, because if we have animals that are more efficient, feed efficient, okay, it allows for a reduction in price cut of the product itself being sold. You also know that, you know, what consumers are concerned with is the product that they're buying some type of negative effect on the environment, which, as I shared earlier on, these animals that are more biologically successful are more feed efficient. They produce less methane. They drink less water. They require less antibiotic support therapy for whatever word you want to use there. And as a consequence, they're more environmentally friendly. Okay. So, you know, and it's a way for the producer to actually, instead of being constantly downgraded or not downgrade is the wrong word, but basically in a consumer's eyes, by being able to select for sustainable individuals, it allows the producer to become a hero.
Right.
And that's what we're all about. You know, we're a minority. Okay. And we're at the short end of the stick all the time. Well, if by using this technology and some of the other things that are being coming on stream, it allows us as an industry to counter what any type of negative perceptions that consumers have. You know, and I think it's really important going forward. You know, today consumers are willing to pay for a product that they know is value added.
Right.
And basically, by using this technology, we can produce a value added product.
Dr. Bill Julian, ladies and gentlemen, has been our guest. He is the founder of Inova Bioscience, and we've been talking about Promagen. Thank Bill. I really do treasure this conversation. I know you and I had a phone conversation not long ago, and that was enlightening. But when we really dig into this about what you can do to help cow-calf producers and also in the milk industry, I think is groundbreaking. And sustainability along with profitability is so vitally important, and that's what everybody is looking for, from consumer to producer. So I want to say, hey, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thank you, sir. Again, I appreciate the opportunity.
That, once again, is Dr. Bill Julian from Inova Biosciences. You can learn more about Promagen and his research by heading to InovaBiosciences.com. That's A-N-O-V-A Biosciences.com. Stay with us, because coming up, we're going to talk about Western artist Hollis Randall Wilford and a new book that details his life and his work. Our guest is first-time author Eric Grant. That's coming up next here on the American Cattleman Podcast.
It's way more than just a hat. It's a piece of American tradition. We're talking about Shorty's Cowboy Hattery, the finest handmade hats in the country. Founded by National Cowgirl Museum and Hall of Fame, Lavona Shorty Coger. For over 30 years, Shorty's Cowboy Hattery has covered the heads of rodeo stars, music stars, working ranch cowboys, and folks that just want to look like one. Shorty's hats remain world famous and are sought after for their attention to detail, intricate sewing process, and signature beaver fur and beaver fur blends. You gotta get you one or two. Visit shortyshattery.com because you deserve the best.
And welcome back to the American Cattlemen Podcast. I'm your host, Chap Ramsey. Grateful to have you along for the ride again today. With me is a young fellow by the name of Eric Grant. Now, if you don't know that name, we won't hold it against you because he's in a really interesting role in public art, of all things. And so why do we have a guy on the American Cattlemen Podcast talking about art? I think you're going to find out right now. Eric, welcome to the American Cattlemen Podcast. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Chip.
So, all right, you're a creator. That's what your business is. But then you went a step further and actually created a book that celebrates a world-renowned artist. Why? First of all, why?
Why? Well, a couple of years ago, I became very worried about Western art and art in general, and the destruction of public art. And whenever you read about history and you read about revolutions that take place and things like that, the first thing that goes, the first thing that gets destroys are the symbols of those cultures and those societies, and that typically is art. And so a great example of that is that Van Gogh painting a couple of months ago that a couple of anti-oil protesters took a can of tomato soup and threw it on this great painting. And I became very concerned about not just art but also society in general, that we have to have respect for those kinds of things. And that's where the motivation or the remotivation for the book came from, because it goes back a lot further than that, but it was what got me off center.
Well, you met Hollis Wilford a long time ago.
Yeah. It's a strange little story, but I had bought a house in Denver, Colorado in 1992 and was just looking for something to hang on the wall. So I went into an antique store and bought a little etching of a wagon train, and I liked it, and that was the only reason I bought it. And I didn't know anything about the artist. I just took it home with me and hung it on the wall. A couple of months later, I started thinking, I wonder who that guy is. And this was before the internet, so you called information, and I called a lot of art galleries around the country, and people knew who he was. He was a very well, as you say, an internationally acclaimed artist at the time. Found out he lived just north of Denver in Loveland, so I called him. And he invited me to come up that afternoon, and I went up to see him, and he had a bunch of etchings laid out. But the first thing that I saw when I pulled in the driveway and I looked in the window was this massive 13-foot-tall clay statue of what eventually stands at the entryway of the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, the Welcome Sundown Cowboy statue. So I knew I was in the presence of somebody great at that point. Long story short, I wrote him a thank you letter the next day, and it was probably the best thing I ever wrote in my life. I don't know where it came from or how it happened, but a couple weeks later, we touched base again, and he invited me to come back up, and he said, hey, I want to talk to you about writing my biography. And that's what set this whole thing in motion. And I was 27 years old at that time. I spent about 6 years off and on with him, interviewing, following him around, watching him create, but never could quite get the words to come out the way I wanted them to come out. So the project kind of fizzled. And there was about a 20-plus year period there where things went pretty quiet for me, but I kept thinking about it. And then in 2020, 2021, I started to become very, very concerned about this. Woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, I've got to go write this book.
And
he is not only an artist in etching, but he does all kinds of art, multimedia.
Yeah, he had amazing versatility. He was a painter. He was a draftsman, etcher. Sculpting was what he was really known for because he had so many high-profile public bronzes, still does. But most artists specialize in one area,
right.
And he didn't. And I think that kept him fresh. I mean, when he got tired of painting, he could go sculpt for a while and those kinds of things. But, yeah, he was an amazingly versatile guy.
What's the book called?
Hollis Williford, The Crossing at the River. Crossing at the River.
Why is it Crossing at the River?
Well, Hollis was... he was brilliant, and you know, each time you create a painting or a bronze, you are setting it at a specific point in time. And Hollis was really, really gifted at placing his work at that point in the plot of that story where you didn't know what the resolution was. And a classic example of that is the Mona Lisa painting. Is she smiling? Is she upset?
Right.
But he was really, really good in that, and so these points of transition were all about Hollis. He was great at everything he did artistically. But every decision that an artist makes, they're always trying to place it in a point in time, and he was brilliant at putting it where that point on the continuum where you didn't know how the action was going to be resolved. So I named it The Crossing at the River to symbolize that point of transition that he was so brilliant at capturing.
The Crossing of the River, right?
Yep.
Talk to us about, and you touched on this just a little bit, Eric, about all of the forms of art and Western art that Hollis did, and sculptures and paintings and etchings, a remarkable talent.
Yeah, his studio was a magical place. There were works that he was working on at the time, works that he had become frustrated with and had kind of set him off to the side. There were Native American artifacts everywhere, paintings from other artists. It was just, you would walk in there and you felt like you were in another world, especially if you like Western art. The other thing that was interesting about his studio was he had a lot of people that would just pop in.
Really?
Native Americans, you know, that he paid to model, for instance, and they were in his studio a lot, and it was just this constant kind of flow of energy, and to him, the Old West never really died. It still existed, and I think it felt like it was his job to, you know, to not just show what the Old West looked like, but also to kind of convey this idea that the Old West and the West continues to live on.
We're visiting with Eric Grant, ladies and gentlemen, from the American Cattleman Podcast. We're talking about Hollis Randall Wilford and the work that he did in Western art. When you sat down to write this book, which is a coffee table book, right?
Yep.
Lots of photographs. And you seem to really delve into his life and what he was thinking about when he was doing whatever is featured on that page. Is that accurate?
Yep, that's accurate. So the book combines both his writings about specific works and also my writings about specific parts of his life. And one of the hang-ups for me as a younger guy writing the book was that I was spending too much time looking at other art books. And most of those books have been written by PhD-level people who knew a lot about art. And, you know, and I thought, you know, all this is doing is intimidating me and keeping me from getting this done. So you're kind of
setting yourself to be like those other people.
Yep.
But you didn't really want to be like those
exactly.
other people.
Exactly. Yeah. So I didn't quite know how to approach the book until I was listening to a book about Custer, George Custer, that Larry McMurtry had written, and it's all done in short form essays. And it doesn't go on an A to Z continuum. It bounces around. It's just different impressions of Custer's life. And I thought, man, I'm an old magazine writer. I can do that. So I loaded up everything I owned in April 2021, and I headed to Oklahoma City, where the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum is, where I would have access to his work and the archivist and those kinds of things. Hollis had passed away in 2007. And decided I was just going to write it. And it was going to be written not in a way that anybody else has ever approached an art book. I was going to write it my way, you know, and go from there.
Why not?
So, yeah.
Where can you purchase the book?
The book's available on our website, which is holliswilliford.com.
And we'll have links to that, ladies and gentlemen, up on the radio blog.
Yeah. Yeah, so that week that I spent, it took me, after 30 years, took me about a week and a half to write the thing.
Really? And so it was there.
It was time to go. I got up every morning at 4 a.m. and I wrote till 10 a.m. and I tried to crank out about 3,000, 4,000 words a day. And, when I got done, I knew I was done. It was there.
And about his art, where can you buy that? Where can you find his art? I suspect museums?
Yeah, that's what's interesting about Hollis's work. You don't see a lot of his work come back out for sale, because the people who collected Hollis's work loved him and they loved his work, and
it's a personal thing.
It's a very personal thing. It's very personal connections, and a lot of work is out there. But a lot of it's in private collections around the country, and that's been kind of the fun part of it, getting to meet these people who are collectors of his and going to see what they have. I wish I'd had access to quite a few of them before we did the book, but they've kind of crawled out of the woodwork, but they just love the man, and they loved his work. But I think, we're kind of going through a generational turnover within the collecting world, and I think you'll see more of his work coming out on the market in the future.
His name is Eric Grant, ladies and gentlemen. Hollis Randall Wilford is the artist, and the book's entitled Crossing the River. Eric, thanks so much for spending some time with us on the American Cattleman Podcast. I think, folks, we talk to a lot of beef producers, and we talk about genetics, and we talk about all kinds of things in the beef industry. This is a first for us, going outside a little bit and, showing some folks some artwork. Good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
What a great story. And I got to tell you, Eric sent us one of the books, and it is beautiful. What a treasure. And you can get your copy of Crossing the River by heading to holliswilliford.com. That's HOLLISWILLIFORD.com. That's time for us to close the gate on this episode of the American Cattleman Podcast. Thanks for coming by. And remember, get your online issue of the American Cattleman magazine at americancattleman.com.